to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. My name is Kenneth Moise. I'm professor at Dell Medical School in UT, Texas at Austin. I'm going to talk today about immunomodulation for red cell alloimmunization now and future aspects. First, my disclaimers and conflicts of interest. I do receive funding for advisory boards and clinical trials from Johnson & Johnson. I am also a consultant to BNN1. That's a U.S. company that produces free DNA for fetal red cell typing. And as you're probably aware, I author multiple chapters and up to date in our paper royalties for that. I'll start with why we're even talking about this today. This is a recent paper we published using data from a commercial laboratory in the United States, looking at prenatal blood screens between 2010 and 2021, almost 10 million pregnancies. And when we concentrated on the major antibodies associated with fetal disease, including big D, big E, Kel, and little c, we found that 1.5% of all the antibody screens were positive for these antibodies. What you see on the right is the trend over time in the course of this, this study. I noticed that RHD seems to be rising. We're not quite sure why that was the case. The other antibodies seem to be fairly stable. And when we look at the incidence of critical antibody titers in these four different antibodies, we find that Kel is almost twice as common as D in 100,000 pregnancies. So this is a disease that's not going to go away anytime soon because we only have rhesus immune globulin to prevent only anti-D formation. So let's go on and talk about the definition of early onset HDFN. We'll define it as a gestational age of 20 to 22 weeks when fetal disease occurs. It can be fetal death, it can be hydrops fetalis, or it can be detection of fetal anemia requiring intrauterine transfusions after the anemia has been detected by middle cerebral artery Doppler. Why is this important? Well, we know that transfusions performed before 20 weeks gestation are associated with a higher rate of procedure-related loss and overall loss. A study by Lindbergh saying that the procedure-related loss was as high as 5%, and the overall loss rate was as high as 24%. And this is related to technical aspects of the procedure with needles that are virtually the size of the vessels we're trying to enter during these procedures. So what do we have to offer these pregnancies if someone presents with early onset disease, say 16 to 18 weeks gestation? What can we offer these pregnancies? In the United States, at least, we typically offer these patients with this history intravenous immune globulin. We try to start that around 12 weeks gestation. They get 1 gram per kilogram per week, and they're followed very closely with serial MCA Dopplers. How does this work? We're not really sure. We do think that IVIG does suppress maternal antibody production. IVIG does attach to the FcRn receptor and probably block the transplacental passage of anti-D. And it may well cross the placenta and cause a reticular endothelial blockade inside of the fetus so that the RE system of the fetus doesn't phagocytize the sensitized red cells. This is the Pettit trial, which is probably one of the biggest trials to talk about the effects of IVIG. This is a trial of 52 patients at 12 fetal centers. It involved 24 patients treated with IVIG in a subsequent pregnancy versus 28 who were not treated. And the outcomes were compared to the previous pregnancy. And one of the most important findings in the trial was that if you compare the previous gestational age at transfusion in the previous pregnancy, you gain 2 weeks in the subsequent pregnancy. And if you don't give IVIG, you end up with an IUT performed 9 days earlier in the subsequent pregnancy. So overall, you gain about 3 weeks as if you don't treat the pregnancy at all. And if you start IVIG early enough, between 10 and 12 weeks, when IgG begins to cross the placenta, you have an overall gain of 25 days and more than a 30% reduction in the need for IUTs at under 20 weeks. So this has become sort of the standard of care in the United States currently for patients with bad EOS who present for a subsequent pregnancy. So what's on the horizon for treatment? So IVIG does prolong the interval to beginning IUTs, but IUTs are still required. We know that the FcRn receptor plays two important functions in physiology. The first is that it maintains the circulating pool of IgG as FcRn receptors line the endothelial cells of blood vessels. And if we look on the left, we see first the blue FcRn receptor represented. You see the red antibody, which is nipocalimid, which is a monoclonal antibody that binds to the FcRn receptor and blocks it. You see the green non-pathogenic IgG antibodies in circulation, and then the yellow antibodies with the pathogenic antibodies. And what happens when you get FcRn blockade is you end up with non-salvage of normal antibodies. So one of the functions of the FcRn is to salvage antibodies and return them to the surface of the endothelial cells and back to circulation. So without that function, the antibodies that are not bound anymore to FcRn are pushed to the lysosome where they're degraded. And what happens with that is you end up with less circulating pool of IgG overall, which would be therapeutic in the case of red cell aluminization because the titer would drop. On the right, you see the main function we all know about is that FcRn has the primary mechanism of transporting IgG across the placenta. So again, when you see blockade, as you see the red nipocalimid attached to the Fc receptor, again, antibodies are not salvaged inside the syncytial trophoblast. They're sent over to the lysosome where they're degraded. And in essence, there's a blockade of antibody crossing to the fetal circulation. And the FcRn receptor is tightly bound to with nipocalimid, and so it doesn't cross into the fetal circulation. Now, in the preclinical studies of this particular antibody, they were performed in cytomus monkeys, and the monkeys were treated, and in fact, we found that the IgG did not cross to the fetus. These fetuses were allowed to mature up to 6 months of age, and they responded to vaccines. And they had no safety concerns were noted in either the pregnant monkeys or their offspring. There were in vitro studies done with the placental cotyledon model. This is a third trimester isolated placenta cotyledon from a human placenta. And what you see here is that we can see that when the nipocalimid is, or M281 as it was called at the time, was put in the maternal compartment, it doesn't show up in the fetal compartment during the life of this particular experiment. Then when Humira, which is alidomide, is added without nipocalimide, you see that when it's put in the maternal circuit, within about 3 hours, it begins to cross over to the fetal circuit, showing that IgG does cross over like an anti-D would. However, when you add Humira with M281 or nipocalimide, you begin to see that there's a blockade. And when you add it over to that side of the maternal compartment, you don't see the Humira crossing over to the fetal side of the compartment, indicating that, in fact, the FcRn blockade is effective. Well, the good news about FcRn blockade is it only affects IgG. It doesn't affect T-cell function. It doesn't affect the other antibodies like IgA, IgE, or IgM. And you can make IgG, as indicated by the vaccine responses in the monkeys. You just don't maintain a large circulating pool of IgG. And of course, if it blocks the placenta, we have to be a little bit concerned that the neonate is not going to get the beneficial effects of IgG from the mother. And so the neonate will be born with lower levels of IVIG, and we have to be concerned about infection. Albumin is also associated with recycling through the use of the FcRn receptor. And therefore, when an FcRn receptor blockade occurs, you would expect albumin levels to decline as they do in pregnancy anyway. Phase one after the monkey studies was done in normal human volunteers. These were not pregnant patients. And what we saw was a fall in the circulating pool of IgG, as you would expect. And by the third week of infusion, the IgG circulating levels in these particular volunteers was 15% of normal, so an 85% reduction, which would again indicate a therapeutic effect that would lower the titer of an anti-red cell antibody in the maternal circulation. So the UNITY trial was the phase two trial conducted throughout the world in patients who had red cell immunization. This was an open label trial, so everybody knew they were being treated. We picked the worst of the worst, so these were patients, again, with EOS disease who had previous IUTs before 24 weeks, They were immunized to either RHD or KEL, and all of the patients had to have an antigen-positive fetus as indicated by free DNA in the pregnancy to be treated. Here's the publication that was appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in August of last year, and we'll talk about the results here in a second. So the phase two trial involved screening the patients and beginning weekly IV infusions of nipocalamide starting at 14 weeks and continuing until 35 weeks. The mothers did receive IVIG supplementation just before delivery at 37 weeks. Neonatal cord levels of IgG were measured, and if they were determined to be very low, the neonates also received supplemental IVIG. There were 23 patients screened for the trial. There were 10 screen failures. The majority of these were due to the presence of an antigen-negative fetus on free DNA. 13 patients were enrolled in 14 pregnancies. One patient aborted her pregnancy because of a genetic disease that was determined to be present. That patient went on to enroll in a subsequent pregnancy. There were 12 live births with one fetal loss at the time of a transfusion at 22 weeks gestation. Here we can see what happens to FcRn when the drug is on board. On the left are the graphs of the patients who had transfusions or did not have transfusions. On the right were the patients with transfusions. And you can see that in a very short period of time, there's complete FcRn blockade as determined by a mononuclear assay throughout the infusions. On the right, you see the one patient who lost the FcRn blockade. This is a patient where the drug was stopped due to growth restriction in a particular fetus, and you can see very quickly the FcRn blockade goes away. So the drug has to be given every week for it to be effective. And here are the results of the trial. The middle column indicates the previous history of a qualifying pregnancy, and the final column indicates the on-study patients. The number of patients receiving IUTs was 84% in the previous pregnancy and 46% in the on-study patients. The primary endpoint of the trial was a live birth at more than 32 weeks without the need for any IUTs. That didn't occur in any of the qualifying pregnancies, but occurred in more than half of the pregnancies that received nipocalimab. The gestational age at the first IUT was markedly increased by 7 weeks. The incidence of high drops went from 53% to no cases of high drops in the treated pregnancies, and the live birth rate went from 38.5% to 92%, and the gestational age was markedly increased in the treated pregnancies. This is an overall graphic of the qualifying pregnancies. You can see the X's indicate the fetal losses. The green bars indicate those that received IVIG, and the brown bars are the pregnancies without IVIG. You can see quite a few number of diamonds, which are the IUTs present in these particular patients. On the right of the treated pregnancies, you'll notice there are four different colors. These are the escalating doses of the drug that were given based on the pharmacokinetics. Again, the bars indicate different colors, indicate different doses, but you can see the red diamonds indicate the IUTs, which seem to occur more often at the lower doses. There was one breakthrough, if you would, with an IUT at 22 weeks, as I mentioned, with a fetal loss, but everyone else had a live-born baby. As far as maternal adverse effects, we were watching very carefully for infection, and there were grade 1 and 2 low-grade infections in 8 of the patients. All of these responded to oral antibiotics and were things like urinary tract infection or mastitis. 2 patients actually had COVID during the COVID epidemic, neither required hospitalization. There were 3 infusion reactions for a total of 1.3%, and most of these were local. Albumin did decrease in the trial as we expected, but all the patients were asymptomatic. There were also this curious increase in total cholesterol, which was noted in the trial. This did go back to normal after the drug was stopped after delivery. As far as the babies were concerned, many of the babies, the majority of the babies, had low levels of IgG. Some received supplementation. Invariably, when we followed these doses out to 6 months, all of the IgG levels returned to normal. As far as infection, 7 of the 12 babies had some evidence of infections that you would expect that would be common in children, including thrush, common cold, and even one baby had COVID-19, not requiring hospitalization. Well, these are a couple of the pictures of the babies. Daisy on the left was the very first patient I had the opportunity to treat, her mother, and she's now 7 years old and doing just fine. On the right is one of our patients from Lithuania, and this is her baby. She'd lost three previous pregnancies, and this was her successful outcome on the drug. So because of the phase 2 trial, we're now moving forward with a worldwide phase 3 trial. This is a randomized clinical trial called Azalea in pregnancy at risk for severe HDFN. The inclusion criteria are a little more lax in that you can be immunized to a variety of antibodies, as you see here. The antecedent pregnancy is not early onset disease, but any transfusion required in a baby or any pregnancy associated with a fetal or neonatal death. The current pregnancy has to have an antigen-positive fetus on board by free DNA, and the participants will be randomized 2-to-1 to nipocalimab versus placebo infusions, and both the investigators and the patients will be blinded to the treatment, and the code will not be broken until 120 patients have been enrolled and reached a full week postpartum state. So if we think about this particular antibody and how it could be used in autoimmune diseases in pregnancy, clearly it will be tested, as we noted, in HDFN, but there is ongoing interest in early trials in FNAIT, or neonatal alloimmune thrombocytopenia, and it might also work in rare cases of neonatal alloimmune neutropenia. Clearly, it could be used in antibody-mediated congenital heart block to decrease the passage of anti-SSA or SSB. And finally, in very rare cases of gestational alloimmune liver disease, this may prove to be useful. So I always love to show this slide at the end of my talk, which is from one of my favorite movies, which is Last of the Mohegans, with two folks looking over the Appalachian Mountains. I do hope to be one of the last of the Mohegans who puts needles into fetuses to put blood in them. I do think one day we'll be treating these pregnancies with medication and immunoblockade. But thank you very much for having me today. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.